putting together public service announcements for Free Radio's upcoming benefit/birthday party. Free Radio, let's see, it's now the 1st of February. That means that next month will be the technical 19th birthday of Free Radio Santa Cruz, liberating the airwaves since 1995.
Cool edit.
Yep, it's on.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
You sure?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Okay. So I'm letting you know as well, February 21st, is that right?
Yes.
Is our benefit/birthday party. That is on a Friday at the Tannery, specifically the Tannery Arts Bar.
Arts Bar and Cafe.
Arts Bar and Cafe. I knew the word cafe was in there somewhere. On just off of Highway 9 there, just right off of Highway 1. February 21st, starting at 6, I think. 6 p.m. we'll have, hopefully, a number of bands. We're still looking for a DJ, but things to eat and drink, and we're going to have a raffle and a drawing and all kinds of fun stuff like that. So keep that in mind. The flyers are coming out by tomorrow, and you'll be seeing those around town. Probably little quarter sheets, but we might have some full-size posters as well. So Free Radio Santa Cruz is having a benefit Friday, February the 21st. Keep that in mind. Save your money and cross your fingers for the raffle we'll be holding. Okay, this is the Mideast Migraine Show. I'm your host, Ren. The Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines is dedicated to the reading of Mr. Max Blumenthal's new book just published last year entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And as I do every Saturday, I'll read you the inside flap of the book cover here. About the author, in Goliath, New York Times best-selling author Max Blumenthal takes us on a journey through the badlands and high roads of Israel-Palestine, painting a startling portrait of Israeli society under the siege of increasingly authoritarian politics as the occupation of the Palestinians deepens. Beginning with the national elections carried out during Israel's war on Gaza in 2008-2009, which brought into power the country's most right-wing government to date, Blumenthal tells the story of Israel in the wake of the collapse of the Oslo peace process. As Blumenthal reveals, Israel has become a country where right-wing leaders like Avigdor Lieberman and Bibi Netanyahu are sacrificing democracy on the altar of their power politics, where the loyal opposition largely and passively stands aside and watches the organized assault on civil liberties, where state-funded Orthodox rabbis publish books that provide instructions on how and when to kill Gentiles, where half of Jewish youth declare their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab, and where mob violence targets Palestinians and African asylum seekers scapegoated by leading government officials as demographic threats. Quote, end quote, demographic threats. Immersing himself like few other journalists inside the world of hardline political leaders and movements, Blumenthal interviews the demagogues and divas in their homes, in the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and in the watering holes where their young acolytes hang out, and speak with those political leaders behind the organized assault on civil liberties. As his journey deepens, he painstakingly reports on the occupied Palestinians, challenging schemes of demographic separation through unarmed protests. He walks at length to the leaders. I'm sorry. He talks at length to the leaders and youth of Palestinian society inside Israel. now targeted by security service dragnets and legislation suppressing their speech, and provides in-depth reporting on the small band of Jewish-Israeli dissidents who have shaken off a conformist mindset that permeates the media, schools, and the military. Through his far-ranging travels, Blumenthal illuminates the present by uncovering the ghosts of the past, the histories of Palestinian neighborhoods and villages now gone and forgotten, how that history has set the stage for the current crisis of Israeli society, and how the Holocaust has been turned into justification for occupation. A brave and unflinching account of the real facts on the ground, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, is an unprecedented and compelling work of journalism. The author, Max Blumenthal, is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Daily Beast, the Nation, the Guardian, the Independent Film Channel, the Huffington Post, Salon, Al Jazeera English, and many other publications. His other book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, was a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller. He blogs at www.maxblumenthal.com. And this book, Goliath, is published by Nation Books, which is a member of the Perseus Books Group, nationbooks.org. All right. Oh, my, it's already 12 minutes after 11. Yeah, I was 3 or 4 minutes late this time, but I feel, well, as I indicated, studio is already occupied, which I was aware of before I left the house because I saw the email that Coral sent out talking about what she was going to do in here today. I'm alone in here right now. I don't know if she's coming back or not. But okay, let's do it. We are now on chapter 26, towards the end of part 3. Lizzie, what was the title again? Oh, yeah. Part 3 was entitled Pirates of the Mediterranean, mainly having to do with his description of the events of May 30th or 31st, 2010, when Israeli naval commandos in international waters outside of Israeli or Gaza territorial waters commandeered and pirated and took control of a flotilla of 5 boats. The Freedom Flotilla, which was organized initially by the Free Gaza Movement, of which I happen to be a founding participant of. And the Israeli commandos gunned down and killed 9 Turkish nationals who were the primary nationality comprising the crew of the largest boat in the flotilla, the Mavi Marmara. This was the terrible May 2010 massacre of 9 individuals and the wounding of several dozens more, a lot more than those 9 who were killed were shot. And so part 3, Pirates of the Mediterranean, was pretty much about that and the backlash in Israel and the bizarre behavior of Israelis in the aftermath of that massacre. We are still on part 3, and I believe this is the closing chapter. Is it not? It is the very short closing 3-page chapter of part 3. Chapter 26, Caliber 3, The Values of Zionism, quote unquote, The Values of Zionism. Just try and make myself a little more comfortable here. It feels funny in this different chair her. Okay, here we go. This, of course, is author Max Blumenthal doing the talking and the writing. I'm just the reader. When I left Sowabi's office and tried to find a minibus out of town, it was already dusk. And it was Shabbat, the Jewish weekly day of rest that turned vast sections of Israel into virtual ghost towns. Even in this mostly Arab city, there was virtually no public transportation that would take me back to my next destination, the coastal city of Haifa. The city that he's talking about being in right now is Jaffa, which is on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. Continuing, my only option was to take a taxi to the town of Hadera, a minibus to Tel Aviv, and another one back up the coast to Haifa. It would be a tortuous journey, but I had interviews in Haifa, which I could not miss. As soon as I boarded the bus from Hadera to Tel Aviv, a frumpy, middle-aged American man with thinning hair and sweat-stained, white-collared shirt stumbled in, bumping his head on the roof as he looked for a seat. "Is this going to Tel Aviv?" he shouted as he slumped into the chair directly beside me. "Tel Aviv? Tel Aviv?" he said in a tinny voice, craning his head around for a response. I did not want to get into a conversation with him, but I needed to put a halt to his incessant questions, so I told him yes. "You're from the U.S.?" he immediately asked me. I tried to hide my grimace. I was exhausted and wanted to take a nap. But without any prompting, the man started into his story. He was a doctor from Long Island, New York, who had been working with a team of heart surgeons at a hospital in Jerusalem. With a few days off from his assignment, he decided to see some of the Holy Land. As our minibus blasted down Israel's central coast toward Tel Aviv, we passed Jewish mitzpim built high on the hills to our left and the remains of, quote, abandoned Arab homes on the coastal dunes to our right. The doctor peered out the window and nudged me with his elbow. "It's amazing what they built, isn't it?" I was tempted to reply that it was almost as remarkable as what they had destroyed, but I had no appetite for antagonizing such a seemingly well-meaning, bumbling character. He was just another American Jew on the trip of his life to Eretz Israel, seeing what he wanted and projecting his dreams onto everything else. Let me interject here for those who have not heard any previous readings from this book. The author, Max Blumenthal, is, of course, a Jew, an American Jew, who spent his formative years in a Hebrew school on the East Coast of the U.S. So this book is written by an American Jew. Apparently quite secular. Okay, continuing. Out of the blue, a skinny Russian teenager with wraparound shades and a gelled-up fauxhawk hairdo demanded my attention from a few seats away. "Hey, Israel good?" he said, flashing a thumbs-up sign at me. "Israel good, yeah?" I pretended I couldn't hear him. After a few minutes of conversation with the doctor, it became clear he had no idea where he was. He told me he had just visited a kibbutz in Gush Etzion, but it was no kibbutz. It was an illegal settlement in the West Bank. He extracted a T-shirt from his duffel bag and presented it to me with pride. It was emblazoned with the logo of a giant bullet inscribed with the name Caliber 3. And this would be the tinny-voiced gentleman doctor speaking here. "On the kibbutz, I went to a shooting range and did an anti-terror training session with some special forces guys," the doctor told me. "These guys were elite soldiers, you know. They had been on missions in Lebanon, Gaza, everywhere. They did a drill for us, and wow, you should have seen them knock down the targets, one terrorist after another." "Israel is good, number one," the Russian guy with the wraparounds muttered at me again. I decided that if I answered in the affirmative, he might shut up. Yeah, Israel is good, real good, I said in a flat tone. It's the best country in the world. It made the desert bloom, invented the cherry tomato and the disc on key and nuclear ambiguity. You happy? I flashed him a big all-American thumbs-up sign. Yeah, the Russian kid exclaimed, pumping his fist. He did not understand a word I was saying, but he seemed satisfied. The doctor, for his part, had continued talking as though nothing had happened. When we were on the shooting range, a few of the Special Forces guys told me the Hezbollah fighters, you know, the terrorists, are so whacked out on cocaine and PCP that they have to shoot them like 40 times before they go down. The scene he had conjured of pious Shia Muslims crowded around a glass table in the Dahiya district, blowing rails of dusty roads before rushing headlong into a hail of machine gun fire by a squad of Jewish Rambos was so absurd it could only have been lifted from the outtakes of an Orientalist exploitation film like Delta Force. But I did not dare ruin the doctor's action-adventure fantasy by making light of his experience. He reminded me of one of my distant relatives from the American Midwest, and I felt a faint sense of pity for him. And besides, the thrill of shooting swarthy terrorists with burly Israel commandos lurking over their shoulders is what droves of Jewish American tourists flocked to the Caliber 3 for. The more tall anti-terror tales they heard, the more their lurid fantasies were satiated. According to Caliber 3's promotional website, quote, "At our program, we combine together the values of Zionism with the excitement and enjoyment of shooting, which makes the activity more meaningful," end quote. As soon as the terrorists arrive at the Caliber 3 range, they are treated to a 15-minute, quote, anti-terror demonstration that features a small team of crack soldiers rushing through a gauntlet of targets, knocking down one after another in a lightning-quick hail of bullets. Each target depicts a different Arab, though not necessarily the kind clad in a baklava that totes an AK-47 semi-automatic rifle or bears any other identifiable terrorist trappings. Some look like average 1970s-era Palestinian men with bushy mustaches, sideburns, dark sunglasses, and tight button-down shirts. A few are smiling. This might seem dangerously irresponsible to outsiders, but in fact it reflects the genuine culture of an army that has seldom regarded distinctions between combatants and civilians as a top priority. Twelve years old and up, you are allowed to shoot. That's what they tell us, an Israeli sniper told Haaretz correspondent Amira Haas in 2004. During the height of the Second Intifada. This is according to what the IDF says to its soldiers. I do not know if this is what the IDF says to the media. Continuation of the quotation there. After observing the drill, tourists turn from spectators to participants, firing on Arab targets with the guidance of their commando instructors. "Your mommy won't be here to protect you, so stand up like a man," an instructor shouted at a 14-year-old American teen after handing him an automatic rifle. "Are you ready to take out a terrorist?" "Yes, I am," the boy proclaimed. According to a profile of Caliber 3 published at Yedioth Ahronoth, a 40-year-old Miami banker named Michael Brown brought his entire family to the shooting range to, quote, "teach them values." Yedioth reported the following. Upon entering the range, his 5-year-old daughter, Tamara, bursts into tears. A half hour later, she is holding a gun and shooting clay bullets like a pro. This is part of their education, Michael says as he proudly watches his daughter. You should know where they come from and also feel some action. End quotation. Halfway through the minibus ride down the coast, the doctor from Long Island trailed off, allowing me to sink into a deep slumber. I awoke with the side of my face pasted to the grease-stained window of the Charut. We were parked at the base of Tel Aviv's noisy central bus station, and the van was empty except for me. I stumbled toward the bus station entrance, opening my bag for the mandatory slipshod search by a disheveled-looking private security guard posted at the gate. Then I headed into the bustling, suit-caked terminal, up the concrete-reinforced staircase leading to the nuclear fallout shelter to get a, quote, toast at one of the food kiosks on the sixth floor. The toasted cardboard-like sandwiches filled with varieties of canned meat, salad, vegetables, and processed cheese had been the staple of my diet inside Israel, where I rarely had time to sit down for a proper meal. My next stop was Haifa, a picturesque city on Israel's northern coast that was home to about 260,000 Jews and 30,000 Palestinian Israelis. It was a, quote, mixed city known as a redoubt from the enforced cultural homogeneity. I still have trouble with some of these words when you have to decide where exactly the proper syllabification goes. It was a mixed city known as a redoubt from the enforced cultural homogeneity that presided over much of the country. With its long history of socialist labor organizing and laid-back beachfront atmosphere, Haifa felt a bit freer than the demographically homogeneous Tel Aviv. However, the deeper I explored Haifa's Arab community, the more I was forced to conclude that there was no sanctuary. It's 11:27 a.m. this Saturday, February 1st, in the year of the Common Era, 2014. Now 11:28 a.m., you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. This is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren. I am reading from Max Blumenthal's 2013 publication, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Now beginning part four, Outcasts, chapter 27. A lesson in Israeli democracy. Just a short walk away from Haifa's Hof HaCarmel train terminal stands a warren of crumbling stone homes with windows filled with cement. They are, quote, absentee properties. The once grand houses of upper-middle-class Palestinians driven from the city by Zionist militias during the 1947 and 48, during 1947 and 48, now left empty by the state, which holds them in perpetuity for refugees whose return it will never allow, and which has placed some on the real estate market in violation of international law. The abandoned homes can be found all over Haifa, along the beach and on the hills overlooking the city's municipal courthouse, itself constructed on confiscated Palestinian land. And only those who managed to maintain total ignorance to Haifa's past and present could avoid seeing the remnants of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe of 1948, that fester like open sores on the city's scenic landscape. When Zionist militias descended on Haifa in early 1948, the traditional coexistence between Jews and Arabs still presided But Mordecai Machleff, the commander of the Carmeli Brigade charged with ethnically cleansing the city, was determined to change all that. His soldiers blared orders through loudspeakers for the Arab population to evacuate. Then he instructed them, "Kill any Arab you encounter, torch all inflammable objects, and force doors open with explosives." That was the instruction. The orders came to fruition in February 1948, months before Israel declared its, quote, independence, when Zionist militias rolled barrels of explosives from Haifa's Jewish neighborhood down on the city's Al-Abbasiyah Arab neighborhood, forcing its residents to flee in terror. 2 months later, the Carmeli Brigade shelled Haifa's central marketplace, sending the rest of the Palestinian population rushing toward the shore. There, as they frantically boarded boats to Lebanon, Gaza, and Acre, now an Israeli city renamed Akko, from Acre to Akko, where many would be expelled again just weeks later, they were literally thrown into the sea. I'm going to read this again, and I want people who are hearing me to understand that we're talking about pre-Israelis, Jewish partisans, and what they're doing to native Palestinian Arabs. 2 months later, the Carmeli Brigade shelled Haifa's central marketplace, sending the rest of the Palestinian population rushing toward the shore. There, as they frantically boarded boats to Lebanon, Gaza, and Acre, now an Israeli city renamed Akko, where many Arabs would be expelled again just weeks later, they, the Palestinian Arabs, were literally thrown into the sea. According to an eyewitness chronicle of the scene, men stepped on their friends and women on their own children. The boats in the port were soon filled with living cargo. The overcrowding in them was horrible. Many turned over and sank with all their passengers. When I first arrived in Haifa in June 2010, the port hosted a ship that served as a powerful reminder that the Nakba was an ongoing process, that the past was not even past, as William Faulkner had said of the American South. It was the rickety Turkish cruise liner raided by Israeli naval commandos and towed back to Haifa, the Mavi Marmara, where the blood of its dead and wounded passengers was promptly hosed off of the top deck, while the Israeli government turned a deaf ear to Turkey's requests to return the ship. Haifa Mayor Yonah Yahav introduced a novel, if not remarkably macabre, idea. Quote, "If Israel decides to confiscate the Turkish ship, I ask for it to be given to the city of Haifa to turn into a floating hotel opposite the city's shore," Yahav wrote in a letter to Defense Minister Ehud Barak. Without any apparent sense of irony, the mayor added, "I feel that Haifa, a symbol of coexistence and cooperation between all religions, would be the appropriate home for this ship, which will turn into an international symbol of reconciliation and hope." End of quote. While the Israeli government struggled to clean up the mess it made on the Mavi Marmara, Haifa's Arab community reeled from the disappearance of one of its most forceful political leaders, Amir Mahol, a human rights activist who had emerged as one of the effective operators in Palestinian-Israeli civil society. Early in the morning on May 6th, Mahal's wife, Janan Abdu, heard a hard knock at the door. 15 men and one woman stood in the shadows demanding entry. Most were masked members of the Assam, heavily armed Israeli riot police, while the rest were grim-looking Shin Bet agents. As soon as Abdu opened the door, the cops rushed inside, opening drawers and cabinets, tossing belongings on the floor, and rushed out with the laptops and cell phones, including those belonging to Mahol's two adolescent daughters. Still clothed in her pajamas, Abdu confronted a Shin Bet agent, demanding to see a court order giving them permission for such an invasive search.
"Who's the man of the house? Where is your husband?" he bellowed.
Mahol stepped forward and clasped onto Abdu's hand. "We both are," he answered. "This is our house."
"Sit down," the agent commanded Abdu, pointing to the family's couch. "We are arresting your husband."
As the police led Mahol away in handcuffs, Abdu admonished the Shin Bet agent. "This is a great lesson for my daughters in their citizenship. What my daughters see of your hatred toward us, I will never be able to erase. This is a great lesson in racism and unfairness, and you will never be able to bullshit them later when you try to teach them about citizenship and Israeli democracy." A little slowly cooling coffee there to help keep my throat open. Back to the book. Abdu welcomed me into the salon of her modest apartment in Haifa's Wadi Nisnas neighborhood in late June 2010, just weeks after the traumatic incident. She was slender and strikingly pretty, with high angular cheekbones and straight, naturally light brown hair. While we sat in her living room and talked, her daughters, both adolescents who shared her sandy brown hair and her husband's greenish eyes, scampered in and out of the house, seemingly impervious to the presence of yet another journalist. Abdu was still shaken by the Shin Bet's invasion of her home. She trembled with anger when she recounted the nightmarish incident that seemed at the center of her thoughts, as though she relived it several times a day. Abdu had recently learned that Mahol's arrest warrant was issued on April 22, while he was attempting to help a group of Bedouins fight Israel's plan to destroy their village in the southern Negev desert. They had 2 weeks to come in to his office, or to get him at home at a normal hour if they wanted, she told me. So it wasn't by accident that they chose to come in at 3 a.m. It was to terrify us and to take him away while he's worried about his family and what's going on. They used his concern about his family when they interrogated him. It was all about humiliation. Only a week before I met Abdu, both her parents died. Her father from cancer and her mother from an asthma attack compounded by grief. At almost the same time, she had to attest their oldest daughter's high school graduation ceremony with us. She had to attend her oldest daughter's high school graduation ceremony without her husband. It was an emotionally wrenching time. "My daughters are filled with anger now," Abdu confided. "When we wait at Gilboa Prison, which is an hour away, for 2 hours in the hot sun and a bad situation, they stare at the jailers, sitting inside with air conditioning and burn with anger. Sometimes it's so humiliating it becomes too much." Abdu said since her husband's case made national news, she received an outpouring of support from people across the country who considered the arrest a grave escalation of the state's authoritarian measures. She had also received a pile of hate mail, including several letters marked with swastikas. The case had begun to complicate her part-time job at a shelter for battered women and sexually abused children. "Now part of the trauma that affected me because of my husband makes it impossible for me to deal with others going through trauma," Abdu told me. "I can't bear the emotional effort anymore. We serve a mixed group of Arabs and Jews, and I'm not able to be in a place anymore where some of the women I work with can threaten me in a racist way for refusing to be their therapist. I just can't take it." Like many of the more assertive Palestinian political activists inside Israel, Mahol and Abdu knew they were being watched, but didn't know
to what degree. Makul's arrest exposed the state's spying as an aggressive, hell-bent operation that had recorded thousands of his phone calls, as many as 13,000 over the last decade. This is in Israel, folks. We're not talking about America's NSA. As many as 13,000 phone calls over the last decade. Once he was jailed, he had to endure what was perhaps the cruelest violation of privacy. All communications with his wife, from letters to phone calls to the non-contact visits he was limited to, would be monitored and recorded by the Shin Bet. The state had hounded Makul since at least 2001, when he served as president of the Arab delegation to the United Nations Durban Conference Against Racism. It was there that he initiated the campaign to indict the state of Israel for the crime of apartheid, an effort that has since emerged as a central plank in the growing international movement to boycott, sanction, and divest from Israel, known as BDS. As the years went on, Makul amplified his calls for a single democratic state between the river and the sea, which would be the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, in which all enjoyed equal rights and representations. He did so not as the chairman of any political party, but as the leader of Itija, the most prominent civil society umbrella group campaigning for Palestinian rights inside Israel. At the grassroots level, he was arguably more influential than any Arab member of Knesset. In 2000, Makul's brother Issam, then a member of Knesset, went public with Israel's worst-kept secret, its nuclear weapons program. In the Knesset debate in 2000, Issam Makul warned that the production of nuclear warheads had turned the country into, and I quote, a poisonous nuclear waste bin that threatened the lives of all its residents. The most right-wing legislators absent, the accusation of treason fell to leaders of the Zionist left, like the Labor Party's Ofir Pines-Paz, who denounced him for, quote, committing a crime against Israeli Arabs today. 3 years later, Issam Makul narrowly survived an assassination attempt when a small, sophisticated bomb exploded beneath his car as he pulled out of his driveway. I know your game. You eat Jews. People like you shouldn't stay in this country, a rightist former Knesset member barked at him during a debate on a popular radio talk show 2 weeks after the bombing. The Jewish terrorist, who was later convicted of attempting to assassinate Issam Makul, Alexander Rabinovich, received a prison term of just 4 years. Amir Makul's prosecution marked the latest phase in the state's campaign against the Palestinian-Israeli political leadership, which had already claimed the career of Azmi Bishara. Like Bishara, Makul was accused of spying for Hezbollah, quote, assisting an enemy in war, a crime that carried a penalty of lifetime imprisonment. Just weeks before Makul's arrest, Omar Saeed, a leading Balad party activist, was arrested at the Jordanian border and eventually charged with meeting the same Hezbollah official. According to the Shin Bet's indictment, which was revealed despite a media gag order, Saeed met the official at a conference he attended in Egypt and rejected his request to spy for Hezbollah. As details of the case seeped out, the Shin Bet's, quote, evidence appeared increasingly absurd. The alleged Hezbollah official, who was said to have attempted to hire Saeed and Makul, turned out to be
It turned out to be Hassan Jaja, a landscape contractor from Jordan, who operated a non-governmental organization in Lebanon dedicated to repairing the environmental damage caused by Israeli airstrikes during its 2006 bombing campaign. Makul, a committed environmentalist, was said to have met Jaja, possibly to discuss his rebuilding projects. Unfortunately for Makul, Jaja had become the Shin Bet's all-purpose Hezbollah agent, whose name could be used to implicate virtually any Palestinian activist they deemed a threat to state security. An all-purpose Hezbollah agent. Jamal Juma, a leading Palestinian activist known for his coordination of nonviolent protests in the West Bank against the Israeli separation wall, was arrested and held incommunicado for weeks in an Israeli military prison after being accused of meeting with Jaja. Curiously, Juma was released without being charged. For Makul's part, he was accused of a grave breach of national security for his alleged coffee date with Jaja, who happened to be an avid grower of herbs and a practitioner of traditional Arabic medicine with no known record of Hezbollah involvement. In Abdu's view, her husband's prosecution was a ploy to discourage Palestinian citizens of Israel from forging bonds of solidarity with the wider Arab world. Amir always said the Arab world is not our enemy. It's our natural community, Abdu remarked. Now, if I meet someone abroad, I'm supposed to be afraid that he's an Arab and ask him if he's from Hezbollah. It's ironic that if I meet a French or Italian person at a conference, I don't have to ask him if he's from an illegal group, but if I meet an Arab, I am not only supposed to ask him, I'm supposed to tell the Shin Bet I met him as soon as I come back to Israel. Orna Cohn, a Jewish Israeli member of Makul's defense team who worked on the staff of the Palestinian-Israeli legal rights group Adalah, told me Makul's indictment was simply part of an ongoing campaign to crush the new generation of Arab political leadership inside Israel. Quotation here. The arrests are all related to the fear of these figures refusing to accept the Jewishness of the state of Israel. Once accepting Israel as a Jewish state became the central demand of negotiations under former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. It put intense pressure on the Palestinians living inside Israel. Forcing the Palestinians to accept the Jewishness of the state, which is like giving blacks the right to vote in South Africa only on the condition that they accept apartheid, that is the key issue now. Because of their refusal to give up their identity, the Palestinian citizens of Israel have become the biggest obstacle to the Zionist dream. End of quotation. So I guess that was Abdu doing the talking there. In days after Makul's arrest, while Abdu and her allies sought for his whereabouts, the Shin Bet told him the Shin Bet held him incommunicado, apparently torturing him during long interrogations designed to coerce him into confessing his crime. Finally, after 12 days, an Israeli judge allowed Makul to meet for 10 minutes, with Abdu and a team of lawyers who had assembled to defend him. Amir was not able to make eye contact with us, Abdu recalled. The lawyers were shocked. He was exhausted, with bruises all over his arms, between his fingers, and with yellow welts across his face. Makul described to them the torture he had just endured, telling the lawyers how Shin Bet agents tied him in a low chair bolted to the ground, binding his arms and legs so each time he moved, it intensified the amount of strain on his joints. He was not allowed to sleep for a full day and denied the chance to bathe.
Then he was left for almost 2 weeks in a tiny cell, only 2 meters wide, without a mattress or blankets. According to Abdu, the Shin Bet manipulated the temperature in the room in order to keep him in a constant state of discomfort, but without allowing him to develop hypothermia. In a country that had not lifted its state of emergency since its foundation, and which instead extended the emergency regulations to allow the state unfettered control over everything from land seizures to ice cream production, just about anything could be justified on the grounds of national security. As Supreme Court Justice Eliakim Rubinstein attempted to explain in a decision affirming the continuation of emergency law, quote, "Israel is a normal country that is not normal," end quote. A little more coffee there. By cultivating an atmosphere of perpetual siege, the state was able to classify citizen activists like Makul as, quote, security prisoners, depriving them of basic civil rights protections, including the right to attorney-client privilege, without risking a substantial public outcry. We can't talk to Amir without the phone tapping system and a glass wall, Cohn told me at the time. We were not even allowed to talk through the glass without a phone. So we can't discuss our defense. How do you prepare a defense when you can't talk to your client about the most important factors without the Shabak, the Shin Bet, recording everything for the prosecution? After arresting Makul, the Shin Bet imposed a blanket gag order on the Israeli media, threatening to strip away Israeli news outlet of its press license for revealing details of the arrest. The clampdown on press freedom might have enraged members of the Israeli media, but none dared to risk the wrath of the dreaded Shin Bet. And so, for several days, the Israeli print and broadcast media faithfully observed the gag order. On May 10th, when tens of thousands of Palestinian Israelis gathered for a spontaneous rally to protest Makul's arrest, quote, steps reminiscent of dark dictatorships, according to the emergency announcement, Haaretz reported the massive protest in a small item on page 10, next to the obituary section, without specifying why the demonstrators had mobilized. Until the following day, when the gag order was lifted, no Israeli news outlet even dared allude to Makul's detention. A little more light here. The role of publicizing Makul's arrest fell to a small, defiant band of left-wing Israeli bloggers. Besides Rechavia Berman and Yossi Gervitz, the online writers included Idan Landau, a Ben-Gurion University linguistics professor and protege of Noam Chomsky, who was denied part of his university salary and sentenced to prison for refusing to perform mandatory Army Reserve duty, and Richard Silverstein, a Seattle-based Jewish-American blogger who often broke Israeli gag orders on security-related stories, brought the disappearance of Makul to a worldwide audience by translating the blogger's reports into English. He then formed a, quote, Free Amir Makul Facebook group that became a clearinghouse for commentary about Makul. Media outlets in Israel won't violate a gag order for fear of losing their press license, or they're just cowardly, Silverstein told me. So this is where I came into the picture. Silverstein broke his first Shin Bet gag order in March 2010, when he became the first person to publish details of the arrest of Anat Kham, a 24-year-old Israeli journalist who had been serving at the time as a clerk in the office of Israeli Army Central Command Director, Major Yair Nave. For 2 months, news of Kham's arrest was suppressed by a Shin Bet gag order and by the complicity of the Israeli media. Kham was accused of leaking thousands of secret Israeli army documents to reporters, including the intrepid Haaretz military correspondent Yuri Blau, revealing the army's willful disregard for a Supreme Court ruling requiring soldiers to avoid assassinating Palestinian militants who complied with arrest orders. According to the documents Kham supplied, Blau, which he later revealed on the pages of Haaretz, the army was given explicit approval to execute unarmed militant leaders even if they consented to arrest, a liberty they took in several cases. Kham was initially charged with endangering national security, a crime that carried a penalty of life in prison. But unlike Makhul, who was held for a time in solitary confinement and kept under lock and key, Kham was allowed to remain under house arrest. In fact, a journalist friend in Tel Aviv told me during the summer of 2010 that Kham was seeking a roommate who was willing to fetch her groceries and tolerate her chain smoking. Perhaps the principal difference between Kham and Makhul, besides the fact that she was Jewish and he was not, was that she was clearly guilty of the crime of exposing army lawlessness, while the charges against Makhul were dubious at best. The blogger's coverage of Kham's case prompted an article in widely read online American publication, The Daily Beast, by Judith Miller, the former New York Times reporter. Parenthetically, Miller gained notoriety for her reports that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and went to jail to protect her conversations with Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, who was indicted and eventually convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice in a case stemming from the White House campaign to defame former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who at the CIA's behest reported that one of the George W. Bush administration accounts related to Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction was bogus and revealed the identity of his wife, covert CIA officer Valerie Plame. Close parentheses. The Miller article on Kham led to a burst of coverage by major news outlets, embarrassing the Israeli government and possibly complicating its case against Kham. But Makhul received no such interest among mainstream American reporters. Judy Miller was willing to do the Kham story probably because she saw a nice Jewish girl in trouble and the gag order was an attack on press freedom, Silverstein commented to me. But with Makhul, there was no Judy Miller to tell the world about his persecution. If only some celebrity journalist had written about the case, it would have made a huge difference. According to Abdu, the Israeli media, most of it, made Makhul appear guilty. Instead of referring to him as the suspected spy, they called him the spy. And as soon as he was charged, they all disappeared. Folks, it's 11:59, 1 minute before noon, this Saturday, February 1, 2014. A couple of reminders here, important reminders. I'm not giving out the phone numbers because I do not accept phone calls from listeners during this reading of M. Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And it is 12 noon here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we're streaming live at freakradio.org. If you're listening to our online radio service, scroll down to the bottom of our main page. Click on the red oval you see there to get the link to the free streaming service. Also, I want to remind those who may be tuning in to the very first time, at least the Saturday version of Mideast Migraines, that all previous shows featuring the reading from Goliath up to this point appear on the archives for Mideast Migraines, also referred to by the old name of the program, Mideast Madness. Those archives are located on a different web service, radioforall.net. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the numerical character 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. To go to and look for the archives of Mideast Migraines or Mideast Madness and look all Saturday programs featuring the reading of sections of the book are entitled Goliath, G-O-L-I-A-T-H, Goliath, part so-and-so, chapter so-and-so through chapter so-and-so. So you can catch up for yourself and increase your appreciation for the context of whatever I'm reading to you today and now. Short musical break. I'll be back in a few minutes.
goes on. You mean the comments following the book itself? Considering I inadvertently left the microphone volume on, I guess some of you out there who didn't take a potty break yourself might have been listening to a conversation I just had. A gentleman held back from calling until the musical break just now. And thanking me for the service I'm providing by reading this. Guy in here in Santa Cruz called me and told me, gave me some important information about online activities, and even though I left the microphone on, let me just clarify. This guy called, a guy from Santa Cruz called in and thanked me for reading the book, and a guy who's listening on air, and keeping in with the ever so underground activity, character of this activity. I won't give his name. Suffice it to say, he's a fan here in Santa Cruz.
And I asked him to continue to listen and by all means tell all his friends and enemies about the reading of this book. And I told him a few things about myself and he of himself. And, oh, I'm so thrilled. Well, I guess I better take this next phone call, too. Let's see what this is about. Consider us to be still on break. Free Radio Santa Cruz. Okay, well, I got the mouthpiece right up against the microphone here, so do you care to introduce yourself? Okay, very inspiring, Pat. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Let's get... Ditto, Pat. Let's get back to the book reading. Thanks for calling back. Bye-bye. And that was the same gentleman calling back. Mr. Pat Kittle doesn't care to hide. In case you didn't quite get all that, or in case Coral didn't get all that through the in-studio monitor, Pat says, let's not hide, let's get the word out to the world and to our fellow Americans about what Israel is really all about and what's actually happening out there. Okay, catch up with reality here. I turned the CD player off, or stop anyway. Okay, back to this chapter in Max Blumenthal's Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Incidentally, I first became acquainted with Mr. Blumenthal in the second half of last year. I went to a talk that he gave at the San Jose Peace and Justice Center, San Jose, California. A lot of fun to listen to. Very handsome young man who is wiser beyond his apparent years. Actually, I believe he's 36 now. Quite a guy. Great to listen to. Very accommodating. And I purchased the book there, and he signed it for me. That's always fun. Okay. Back to this chapter, A Lesson in Israeli Democracy. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org and broadcasting at 101.3 FM. Back to the book. Since 1967, the State of Israel has detained at least 750,000 Palestinians in its prisons, including 10,000 women. According to the Palestinian prisoner rights group, Adamir, Israel currently holds over 4,500 political prisoners, including more than 200 children and 322 people jailed without charges. Those it has labeled, quote, administrative detainees. In its prosecutions of so-called security prisoners like Mahul, the state boasts a 99.74% conviction rate. Many of its magistrate judges who rule in such cases gained their initial legal experience presiding over the military justice system that rules the occupied West Bank, learning through a day-to-day routine of show trials to accept Shin Bet and Army's arguments as gospel. A perfect exhibit of the seamless nexus between Israel's judicial system and the military was Einat Ron, the magistrate judge who approved the gag order in Anat Kham's case. For much of his career, Ron served as the Army's chief military prosecutor, advising the Army to lie to human rights groups to cover up the killing of an 11-year-old Palestinian boy, Khalil al-Mughrabi, by a group of soldiers in 2003. Even after Ron's deceit, made the pages of the international media, she was promoted to serve in Israel's civilian court system. With her record of complete deference to the Army and the security services, perhaps she was the perfect judge to rule on a case like Com's. In the end, Com received 4.5 years in jail for exposing the Army's illegal killings, a conviction that revealed the power the occupation exerted over Israel's legal system and the whole of society. I'm going to read that sentence or two again, because that is, contains another very, very key point of understanding to appreciate the situation in Israel and Palestine. Once again, Inot Roan, the magistrate judge who approved the gag order in Inot Com's case, I'm trying to make this concise here so I can know exactly. Yes. Inot Roan, the magistrate judge who approved the gag order in Inot Com's case, I'm sorry, Com, referring to this Inot Com. Com received 4.5 years in jail for exposing the Army's illegal killings. Here's the clincher, folks. A conviction that revealed the power that the occupation, the Israel's illegal occupation of Palestinian territories, exerted over Israel's legal system and the whole of society. In other words, the Israeli Defense Forces, so-called defense forces, the power that they wield and the influence that they have over the overall scene tends to exert itself over Israel's legal system and the whole of society. Continuing now with the chapter. Yuri Blau, the reporter who relied on Com's documents to publicize the killings, was prosecuted and sentenced to 4 months in prison for possession of classified information without intent to harm state security. Like so many other Palestinian quote-unquote security prisoners, Mahul was presented with a stark option: go to trial and face an almost certain conviction, leading to a possible lifetime sentence, or sign a plea bargain granting him a lighter sentence in exchange for an admission of guilt. The plea deal would validate the Shin Bet's bogus indictment, but it would allow him to reunite with his wife and daughters in a few years. On his lawyer's advice, he accepted it, receiving a sentence of 9 years in the Gilboa prison for a lesser charge than, quote, aiding an enemy in war. Parenthetically, Omar Saeed also took a plea deal, resulting in a 7-month sentence. There, he would share facilities with Palestinians arrested in the occupied territories, helping coordinate and report on the landmark hunger strikes that they planned in the near future and which weakened the impact of repressive Shin Bet measures such as administrative detention and solitary confinement. Left at home without her husband, Abdu redoubled her efforts to publicize his case, and despite the lingering trauma of his disappearance, delved into human rights activism with renewed intensity. "I have no choice but to campaign for my rights," she told me. "It's not enough to just live. This is about how to live. It's not enough to eat and drink and be able to say, 'I'm alive.' You have to have the right to be proud of who you are and hold on to your dignity, to preserve your rights as a human being and be part of a community. So for me, the choice is between two things, to be or not to be."
Hey, Coral, are we still streaming?
Of course.
Can I just make a quick check here?
Still alive and okay. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure that we're being recorded for posterity so that you and your friends can relocate the reading of these chapters of the book Goliath here
on radioforall.net at a future date. Again, we just began, closer to the beginning of today's broadcast, to read, we just began part four, entitled Outcasts. And the details of the chapters I've read to you certainly says something about why this part four is entitled Outcasts. Now we begin chapter 28, Just Being a Guy. By the way, it's 12:20 p.m. Saturday, February 1, 2014, on the Mideast Migraine Show, Free Radio Santa Cruz. Chapter 28, Just Being a Guy. An hour after I left Janan Abdu's home, I was sitting on a plastic chair in the garden at Youssef's, a local shisha spot that served as one of the few gathering places for Haifa's young Arab men. Seated across from me and sharing a hookah were Ala and Amir, both Haifa University graduates in their mid-20s. Though neither was involved in any form of activism, the Shin Bet had called each in for an interrogation during the past year, a bewildering experience that neither could fully explain. Fearing more Shin Bet harassment, they asked me not to use their last names in anything I published. This is author Max Blumenthal speaking here. Fearing more Shin Bet harassment, they, the two gentlemen, asked me, Max, not to use their last names in anything I published. I had not expected anything beyond a leisurely chat, but as soon as we sat down, Ala and Amir made it clear they wanted to tell me all about their situation. They were not particularly political, but life in Israel was becoming unbearable for them and their community. And instead of joining the struggle, they were among those seeking an exit strategy. With designer jeans and a polo shirt, Ala could have passed for a young professional in any city in the world. He had sandy brown hair with a tuft that hung over his forehead, accentuating his boyish features. Amir arrived wearing a t-shirt and shorts. He was heavy-set and jocular, laughing heartily at the sarcastic asides I used to break up the mood when I sensed the discussion was becoming excessively gloomy. The two were at the top of the Palestinian totem pole with Israeli IDs that allowed them the freedom to travel everywhere except, quote, enemy Arab states. When we met, Ala and Amir were preparing for a trip to Switzerland, a choice summer destination for young Western backpackers seeking rugged outdoor fun. The two earned a good living in Haifa, in Haifa's booming tech sector, a conglomerate of startup companies and multinational corporations drawing largely from the talent cultivated at the city's Technion University, known as Israel's version of MIT. Haifa's tech, quote, miracle inspired the title of a best-selling book, Startup Nation, co-authored by Dan Senor, an advisor to Mitt Romney in his presidential campaign and a former public relations official in the coalition provisional authority that governed Iraq after the invasion. The book had become a key vehicle for Israeli Hasbara, with innovative startups serving as a counterweight against charges of human rights violations. Jerusalem-based writer David Hazzoni hailed the publication of Startup Nation as one of the three biggest Hasbara triumphs of 2010, gushing, quote, Singer and Center succeeded in changing the subject and constructing a positive image of Israel that is not all war, end quote. And a reminder, the word Hasbara is, I believe, an Israeli term referring to Israel's encouraged philosophy of getting, in particular, its Jewish citizens to put spin on any news items that come out of Israel regarding anything, and it refers to the practice of spinning these factoids and news reports as into something that reflects Israel in the most positive light. That's what Hasbara means. Okay, continuing with chapter, just being a guy. Because Israel's tech sector was intimately intertwined with its military apparatus, Technion was a key idea factory for the Army's robotic warfare projects. It was virtually free of Palestinians. Indeed, Allah and Amir were among the only 2.8% of Arabs who had found places in Israel's startup nation. The exclusive environment was largely the byproduct of the influence of Israeli Army's Unit 8200, a hyper-secretive cyber warfare division that trained soldiers in the dark arts of surveillance and hacking before sending them off into the job market. As Tobias Buck reported in Financial Times, one important reason for the ubiquity of 8200 alumni in the high-tech sector is personal connections. Many Israeli startups are founded by men and women who work together in the unit. When hiring new engineers and programmers, startup founders typically turn to their former unit, Unit 8200, safe in the knowledge that the military has invested heavily in selecting and training its recruits. Few startup companies reported receiving so few applications from qualified Arabs in Israel, while many of those who managed to find jobs in the industry found the social climate unbearable. For Allah, the hostility began at the Technion, where one of his professors changed the username on his computer to Terrorist. Hired to work at nanotechnology at a local firm, Allah fell out of favor with his co-workers during Operation Cast Lead, referring, of course, to Israel's initial invasion and subsequent massacre of the Gazan Palestinians in late 2008 into 2009, Operation Cast Lead. I work in a small firm, so everyone is like family, he told me. And during the attack, all the Israelis I worked with were watching their news channels, reporting from the outside, showing a little puff of smoke, and then announcing, "We're winning!" I was watching Al Jazeera, and I saw the suffering inside Gaza. One day, five of them cornered me and began shouting all the propaganda at me that they were hearing on the news. I realized that if I wanted to keep my job, I had to stop arguing, and that only added to my stress. Allah had lost a close friend during the October 2000 riots, during which young Palestinians demonstrated in solidarity with the West Bank and Gaza, and mowed down by border police gunfire. I told them that you have the green light for any action necessary to bring about the rule of law, Ehud Barak, then the prime minister, said of his instructions to the security guards he gathered in his living room for a meeting about suppressing the demonstrations. When the smoke cleared, 13 unarmed civilians, all young Palestinian citizens of Israel, from the cities of Nazareth, Haifa, and Al-Fam, lay dead. Scores more were badly injured by the fusillade of rubber bullets the border police sprayed into crowds of demonstrators. After the killings, Allah watched with dismay as the Israeli government ignored the findings of the Orr Commission, a badly flawed government inquiry into the police shooting of rioters that nonetheless admonished the state to, and I quote, work to wipe out the stain of discrimination against its Arab citizens in its various forms and expressions. The October 2001 killings were a transformative event for the Oslo generation of Arab youth inside Israel. The Palestinian minority in Israel is more vocal and more aware and struggling for the rights it was denied during the Oslo era in the 90s.
Orna Cohn, the lawyer from the Adala Center for Legal Rights, told me, and continues, they are thinking about more than what they have and what benefits they can receive, and instead about their rights as citizens. And since they have been told over and over that they live in a democracy, not a tyranny, the ongoing discrimination made it inevitable that the struggle would get more serious. Then, of course, there was also those who just gave up and want to leave for a better life somewhere else. Adala's views neatly encapsulated the sensibility of the post-Oslo generation of Palestinian youth inside Israel. All we are asking for is equality, he said, for better schools, for new parks, for urbanization policies. But from their point of view, this would lead to social disorder. So they keep our villages in the old way. They reinforce the patriarchy, the family feuds, all to keep distracted from our rights. What gets to me the most is that we are still called a demographic threat, Amir added, a state in the 21st century where major government officials use the term demographic bomb. Never mind that the birth rate is going down so much that this isn't even an issue. It's just so insulting. According to Allah, though he had access to employment and opportunities for economic advancement, the gap between him and less educated Arabs in Israel was yawning. Besides the fact that Arab schools were badly overcrowded and under-resourced, his younger sister was struggling to learn in a classroom with 40 other students, the Judaization policies in the Galilee had deliberately stifled development in Arab towns. You can't break out of the patriarchal structure, and you're just stuck there, he said. Whether it's the lack of health clinics or good schools, the whole program is systematic. Allah pointed me to a report in Haaretz dated February 13, 2008, that he said drove him crazy. The report opened. The Interior Ministry plans to submit to the government a proposal this year to build a new Arab city. Interior Minister Meir Shitrit of Kadima Party announced yesterday. If the plan goes through, it will be the first time such a city is built in Israel, aside from towns meant to absorb the Bedouin. Quote, the aim is a modern city that any young couple will be able to buy a house in and live there, as in any other modern city in the world, Shitrit said. To Allah's chagrin, just as soon as the new Arab city was proposed, the first of its kind since Israel's foundation, the plan was withdrawn following indignant protests by legislators such as David Rotem. The government has lost its Zionism entirely, Rotem howled. This left Haifa as one of the only escapes from the state-engineered stagnation of village life. There is limited parking and no parks. There is limited parking and no parks in our neighborhoods here, Amir contended, but Haifa is still attractive for Arabs. It has a more liberal setting than any other cities. You can feel unbound from tradition here. But even in the big city, Arabs experience sustained pressure to participate in the Jewish state security sector. We overheard five guys talking the other day about how they wanted to be a security guard at a coffee shop or a hospital, Allah recalled. You can't really be friends with most people here or talk to them about serious things. It's hard to blame them because they have no motivation to do anything outside the box. But then you start to feel alone when you only have four or five friends. The pressure was so extreme it played out in everyday conversations. Every Arab here has made an active decision on whether they want to use the Arabic pronunciation of the letter R or the Jewish way when they speak Hebrew, Allah remarked. A psychologist told me the Arabs who use the Jewish R are trying to show the Jews that they are the good Arabs, capital G, capital A. Good Arabs, Amir added. Or they roll their R's the Arabic way to show they're not inferior. There are no institutions in this country to promote multicultural values, so everyone has to figure out their own way to deal with the situation. While typing Allah and Amir's comments in my laptop, I thought about my friend Yasmina, name change to protect identity, a 24-year-old Arab woman who had left Nazareth, where she was raised by a prominent Muslim family, for the hipster scene of Tel Aviv. She had dated Jewish men, including a soldier, partied at Bohemian bars, vacationed in Berlin. That's right, Berlin, Germany. A favorite summer getaway spot for young Israelis, Berlin is, and maintained a vegan lifestyle that annoyed her father, who was the quintessential meat-eating conservative patriarch. If I accompanied Yasmina anywhere near Tel Aviv's trendy Rothschild Boulevard, there was hardly a place we could go without a few Ashkenazi hipsters rushing forward to greet her. In fact, she hosted her own semi-satirical Facebook fan club with more than 40 members, mostly Jewish Israeli guys who hung around the local bohemian and activist scene. Yasmina could speak Hebrew with a flawless Jewish Israeli accent. She claimed this helped her insinuate herself into the homogeneously Jewish cultural framework of Tel Aviv. Her linguistic skills came in handy when she dropped me off at Ben-Gurion International Airport in June 2009. At a checkpoint outside the airport where Arabs were frequently taken out of their vehicles for lengthy searches, she passed through with ease. The soldier thought I was Jewish, Yasmina told me with a contented grin. With my Hebrew, I can convince most Israelis that I'm a Jewish girl. Maybe from Iraq or Yemen. Though she had easily assimilated into a mostly Jewish, Europeanized social setting, Yasmina could hardly be called a sellout or even a good Arab. Capital G, capital A. Only a few of her Jewish friends knew that she had named her bicycle Tufik, after Tufik Zayad, the Palestinian-Israeli poet and politician who helped organize the first Land Day protests. She made no secret of her rejection to Zionism, and few of her Tel Aviv friends seemed threatened by it. The Israeli flag will never represent me, and I will never feel at home in this place as long as it waves over my head, she confided to me once. No one could have questioned her desire for equal rights. However, when faced with a choice between the suffocating environment of village life, the activist path of unending rancorous struggle, and the individualistic cloistered cultural bubble of Tel Aviv life with his Western European escape valve, the last option was the most appealing. For her and for many other educated cosmopolitan Arabs, the fleeting illusion of normality was better than the destiny assigned to them by the Jewish state. Allah and Amir told me they understood Yasmina's choice, even if they choose to handle the same predicament in a different way. I asked them if they ever thought about leaving Israel for good. Only a few of us had the opportunity to leave, so there is not that much guilt around the issue, Allah said. But everyone who does have the opportunity, especially Arab Christians, they are at least thinking about it. He added, in this place, sometimes you want to stop being an Arab and just start being a guy. It's 12:39. In real time, I have about 15 minutes left. before I need to close out the show. Let's see. This should be able to get through this next chapter, and that will complete part four, Outcasts. Clogging up again in the old larynx here. Coffee's cold, but it still feels good. Chapter 29, Leaving Haifa. Whenever I was in Haifa, I often arranged a rendezvous with my friends and contacts at Fatouche, a Palestinian restaurant that used to serve as a wine cellar for the German Templars during the Crusades. This area, now known as the German Colony, is in a particularly touristy section of Haifa. The restaurant is located on Ben-Gurion Avenue, a long promenade that leads west toward the spectacular Baha'i Gardens atop Mount Carmel, where the administrative heart of the world's Baha'i religious community is located. While seated at a long table in Fatouche's outdoor garden, listening to a melange of English, Arabic, and Hebrew amid a crowd of Palestinians, Jews, and internationals, it is sometimes possible to imagine the kind of place Israel could be if it ever managed to shed its settler colonial armor. However, the atmosphere of easy coexistence that sometimes blossomed inside the gardens of Fatouche did not develop because of the prevailing culture of Haifa, but in spite of it. Throughout the day, small groups of young soldiers can be seen milling around Ben-Gurion Avenue. Some wear uniforms, while some just wear shorts and a t-shirt. But the automatic rifle slung over the shoulder seems to be a requisite piece of fashion. Many of the soldiers are on leave, staying at a hotel-style barracks on the street. Others are stationed at the nearby Naval Cadet School. They are the pride of Israeli society, members of its most respected institution, an army that most Jewish citizens believe protects them from imminent destruction. But to local Palestinian Arabs, the uniforms and weapons represent an omnipresent symbol of hostility and aggression. To them, they're serving their country, Allah commented. But to me, their presence is an attack on me and who I am. Amir added, I can't stand seeing their guns every time I walk out on the street. I hate what it reminds me of. By chance, on the night after I met Allah and Amir, I encountered a young woman who dared to challenge Haifa's militaristic environment, and whose symbolic act of defiance led to her expulsion from Israeli society. After I left Yusuf's Cafe, my friend Fadi, name changed, a 25-year-old videographer I had met while I was studying at New York University, picked me up in a car filled with two 20-something Palestinian women. We drove to an apartment in the hills of Haifa, high above the harbor, and gathered in a salon with a bottle of arak, a cheap, highly alcoholic anise-based aperitif. As Fadi, who was ubiquitous at leftist cultural happenings from Tel Aviv to Jenin, busied himself with the younger woman, I fell into conversation with the other, who spoke better English. She was a club promoter and bartender named Fida Kiwan, with a nose ring, a leather armband, and a brash demeanor, she reminded me of a prettier Levantine version of Janis Joplin. Fida had heard from Fadi that I was a journalist and was now eager to tell me about her year from hell. More than a year ago, Fida and a business partner opened a cafe in Haifa called Azad, or Free People. With this easygoing bohemian atmosphere and constantly flowing supply of Taibe, a local Palestinian beer, Azad became a favorite of young people and creative class types from around the country, both Arabs and Jews. To cultivate the cafe as a sanctuary of equal coexistence, its owners insisted on enforcing a policy that defied Israeli society's measure of militarism, namely, no uniforms allowed, read the sign on its door. The policy applied not just to soldiers, but also to Boy Scouts and security personnel, to anyone who identified with the state's exclusive institutions. It was our cafe, and we wanted to keep it clear of any barriers to an open dialogue, she told me while I threw back another glass of arak. We thought we would stand up for local values, and that meant that our identity as Palestinians had to be respected. So why should we allow people to bring guns inside and wear uniforms that we identify with our own oppression? In February 2010, an army sergeant named Raviv Roth stomped into the cafe in his uniform with a gun slung over his shoulder and demanded service. I told him we have a policy against uniforms, so if he comes back in civilian clothes, I will be happy to serve him, and I'll give him the best service he's ever had, Fida recalled. Instead of returning without his olive drab, the young man called his father, a well-connected local politician, who promptly called the police demanding they shut down the cafe. But when the police arrived, they told the angry young man there was nothing they could do. Azad had the right to refuse service to customers just as other private businesses in Israel did. The guy was used to being treated like he ran the show, Fida said. I didn't break any laws at all, but he and his father believed there was a higher law I had to follow. Within hours, reports of Fida's policy and the insult it caused to the golden sons and daughters of Eretz Israel were broadcast on the Israeli national news to an audience of millions. As the national outrage mounted, one Israeli citizen took the initiative, forming a Facebook group called Boycott Azad. Thousands of Israelis joined almost overnight, filling the page with vitriolic commentary about Fida, her cafe, and Palestinians in general. What really set me over the edge, recalled Allah, was seeing hundreds and hundreds of people posting all those racist talkbacks and threats on the Boycott Azad Facebook page. And doing it under their own names, next to their pictures, like they were proud to think this way. In March, a mob of Israeli students and soldiers, including members of the Likud-linked Im Tirtzu student group, rallied outside the cafe, waving flags and holding signs that read, "Don't discriminate against soldiers," and "Soldiers keep us safe." After a raucous rendition of the Israeli national anthem, protesters climbed atop the roof of Azad and draped Israeli flags over the cafe's sign, while blocking the view of the patrons inside with an even larger Israeli flag. A few police officers stood by and watched without doing a thing. Images of the scene recalled images from Shuhada Street in Hebron, where violent Jewish settlers living under the protection of Israeli soldiers have forced hundreds of Palestinian shops to close, marking the triumph of each store driven out of business by spray painting a Star of David on its front door or by planting an Israeli flag on its roof. The episode shook the local Palestinian community. At the leftist bars located near Azad on Haifa's Masada Street, the attacks were discussed in terms of a decisive social rupture. What happened with Azad was a terrible sign. We're just waiting for the next escalation now, a local theater director told me. I'm reading very quickly here because I got 5 minutes to finish the chapter. To young Palestinian Arabs like Fadi, the episode smacked of hypocrisy. I can't get into half I can't get into half the nightclubs in Tel Aviv, Fadi remarked to me, because the bouncers will stand outside asking everyone for proof of military service. It's the same for jobs. Everywhere I apply, more and more companies ask for proof that I did Army. I see more and more want ads in the paper saying Army service required. This is just another way of saying no Arabs allowed because we don't serve in the Army. We are discriminated against all the time, but does the whole country stop to protest for one of us? Of course not. In March, the Haifa municipality officially sanctioned the mob campaign against Azad, issuing an order to shut down the cafe. But when Adalah, the local Arab minority legal rights center, challenged the order in the Haifa Court for Local Affairs, a judge struck it down, noting in her decision, the alleged discrimination against Sergeant Roth was not supported by even a shred of evidence when the motion was submitted to the court. Frustrated by the restrictions imposed on him by the law, Sergeant Roth, the aggrieved soldier, filed a civil lawsuit against Azad. On June 30, 2010, Haifa's magistrate court judge, Shimon Sher, ruled that the owners of Azad had to pay Roth $4,373 in punitive damages and around $600 to cover the legal costs they incurred when he sued them. Though they had broken no laws, Judge Shear placed the blame squarely on the owners for all the troubles they had caused the good people of Haifa. Quote, the action taken by the restaurant owner only increased tensions and led to a situation where his attempt to bring about equality created inequality, which I am certain neither side desires, Shear declared in his ruling. Weeks after the ruling, Azad closed down for good. Now I'm stuck with the legal bills and I'm thousands of shekels in debt because I can't pay the fucking loan. Can't pay back the fucking loan. All because one soldier decided he was the victim and because the army turned out to be the real owner of my restaurant. Because of that, I am fucked, Fida complained to me. She had gone from investing her money and energy into a space that encouraged, quote, open dialogue, to gathering her bundles and preparing to relocate to Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian authorities occupied Bantustan. I asked her if by leaving Israel for the West Bank, she was essentially self-transferring. It's complete shit to live under occupation, for sure, but at least it's honest, she responded. At least all the people know they are up against the Israeli occupation and don't pretend otherwise. Here they're still occupied. All our lives are controlled. Everything we do is subject to the power of the Jewish state. But we can't be honest about it. Look, she continued, it's not easy being a woman in the West Bank. It's a double occupation, you know. You have to deal with the Israelis and the fucked up sexist attitudes. But I'd rather live with people who recognize the reality of the occupation than be here where the occupation is hidden behind all these layers of fake democracy, end quote. The following morning, as the sun rose above the Mediterranean sky, sending a shimmering glow across Haifa's port that illuminated the outlines of the Lebanese coast to the north, I wandered out into the road for a coffee at one of the cafes on Masada Street. I realized that I was only blocks away from Azad, which lay empty on Hillel Street. Out of curiosity, I decided to pass by the shuttered restaurant. There, I found the cafe's front windows shattered by vandals who left the ground covered in shards of glass. Later in the day, when I described the scene to Fadi, he muttered, "They did it again." End of chapter, and that closes the comparatively short part 4, which was entitled Outcasts, I believe. Outcasts. Part 4 was Outcasts. When I return next Saturday, I will begin part 5 entitled What Lies Beneath the Forest. I already have an idea of what that refers to. And And again, this is in the course of reading Max Blumenthal's 2013 publication, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. DJ Cañon, I expect to be entering very shortly. I'm going to make way for Miss Señor Cañon. The transition from this show to his should go fairly smoothly, even though we are experiencing some sharing of the computer equipment right now, mainly in preparation for our benefit. This month, February 21st, a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz, which will also serve as our 19th birthday party, which actually falls in March. But now that it is the 1st of February, I can merely say which falls next month. Okay, this is Ren Tawil for Mideast Migraines. Join me for the continuation, beginning Part 5 of Goliath, next Saturday at 11 a.m. Please tell all your friends, especially if your friends are Jewish, to listen to 101.3 FM or go to freakradio.org and click on that red oval for the streaming service. 11 a.m. next Saturday, and I will also be with you this Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. for the other weekly edition of Mideast Migraines, 3 p.m. on Monday. I will take phone calls and openly uncover for you the phone numbers direct to the studio, assuming you don't have them to begin with. See you later.